Rachel Botsman is on the show with me today. Rachel is the author of a terrific new book called Who Can You Trust? How Technology Brought Us Together and How It Might Drive Us Apart. It is fascinating to read because we're in an era now of a time when if you rent a home with Airbnb or get into the back of an Uber or a Lyft or buy something on eBay, there's a huge amount of trust involved. And ironically, we're doing those things at the same time that trust in traditional institutions is at an all-time low. The government, business, banks, media, etc. So this is a great time to talk to her about this subject. And Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. Yeah, you know, in addition to the lack of trust in big institutions, we've also had these data breaches recently at big companies like Equifax and Sony and Target and Yahoo. And yet people are still willingly giving up their information to organizations like Facebook. Is it that people just don't care or that they trust the wrong people?
Well, yeah, I think one of the challenges is that we are giving our trust away too easily, giving our trust away often without thinking about it to the wrong people in the wrong places. But very often are not. It actually comes down to apathy, that we're just not thinking about the lopsided trade-offs that we make when we give our data away in exchange for some kind of benefit or social connection. And then other people just frankly don't care until something goes wrong, and that's when we really become aware of how our trust can be breached.
Yeah, you write in the book about generalized trust and distributed trust. What's the difference?
Well, I actually write about institutional trust and distributed trust. So
okay.
Generalized trust is sort of the general trust that we place in things and information, whereas personalized trust is the trust that we place in people. But what I'm really talking about in the book is this shift in trust from institutions that has existed for a very long period of time, whether that be charities, the media, government, business, even religious organizations, and how that's being eroded, how our faith in these systems and the leaders is really unraveling at a frightening rate. But at the same time, we're seeing these new forms of trust rise up that are quite remarkable in terms of how we're trusting complete strangers over the internet, whether that be through cryptocurrency, staying on Airbnb, getting in an Uber, or even finding a date online.
Yeah, why do people have more faith in something like Bitcoin than they do in more stable things like a stock index fund?
Yeah, intuitively it doesn't make sense, right? So I think what's happening is that people are starting to realize they don't understand, or they don't know what happens, I should say, in these black box systems. And financial systems is a big black box. So how do the banks use their money? How does this money move around? What am I really being charged for? So in all different areas of our lives, we're looking for these things where we feel in more control in a strange way, where we can see there's a transparency in the system. And also it's a system that bypasses, for the most part, a large traditional institution, so it feels like an alternative. And this is very common. If you think in your own life, when, you know, trust collapses in one place, you often look for trust in another place. So if you, you know, trust is eroded in a relationship, you might look to another person for that kind of support. So this is something that's very human to us. It's not that our trust disappears, it's that we need to give it away somewhere, so we start looking for alternatives.
I think it's funny to hear you describe that people don't trust banks because they don't understand them, and yet they're investing in Bitcoin when they don't even know what that is.
I know. Let's not try and get into Bitcoin and the blockchain. I mean, I think it's in a bubble. If I was investing, I would be investing in Ether or Ripple. But I think people do intuitively understand what it is. I think so, anyway.
Do you think when we get to the era of self-driving cars, which may be 5 years away or 20 years away, who can tell, but every car company and every high-tech company is moving us towards that, do you think that we will trust self-driving cars?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I think, you know, human beings, they're wired to take what I call a trust leap. A trust leap is when we take a risk to do something new or to do it differently because we can see the benefit of that. And, you know, I'm a terrible driver. I cannot wait for a self-driving car. A lot of people don't like sitting in traffic. So there's a lot of reasons for people to jump into a self-driving car. And one of the interviews I found the most fascinating in the book was the people designing these cars, both the programmers, the designers, the manufacturers. They're not worried whether we're going to trust the car. They're worried that we're just going to trust it too much and we're going to get bored and fall asleep, even at the wheel. And that's the challenge, is that you still need the human being to be alert even when the machine takes over. So, you know, I think it's 5 years off, and I think, you know, it seems like an extraordinary idea, letting a car, trusting a car to drive itself. But within my children's generation, within their lifetime, they'll need permission as a human, I think, to drive a vehicle.
Interesting. Now, speaking of cars, you have a great story I'd like you to share in the book about a woman calling the NRMA, which is the Australian version of AAA here in the United States, the auto club, effectively.
Yeah.
Would you share that?
Yeah. So I sit on the board of the NRMA, and we are the most trusted organization in Australia, and I think they've got 4 or 5 million members. And so I was really intrigued as to why do people trust us. And they said, oh, you should go in the call center. And when I was in the call center, this one of the people answered the phone, they told me this story of this woman who was driving along a highway, and she tragically realized that this was the place her son had passed away a few years ago. And she started to have a panic attack. So she pulled over to the side of the road, and she called the NRMA, and our driver came out, and there was nothing wrong with her car. It hadn't broken down. He just sat with her for 2 hours until she was ready to drive again and offered her to drive home. So what we asked this lady was, why did you call the NRMA? You know, why didn't you call, she was married, why didn't you call your husband, why didn't you call a friend, why didn't you call the police, why didn't you call an ambulance? And she said, I knew you guys would show up. And that's trust. That's having faith in a system or a person that you'll be there when it counts.
Yeah.
And to me, it really, I don't know, it really struck a chord that people have that kind of relationship, that kind of confidence in the NRMA.
Nice to hear that there's some organization that's been around for a while that people still do have faith in. And yet we have the other end of the spectrum where companies have failed people's trust. Mm. How does a company get that trust back?
It's the number one question I ask. How do we rebuild trust? How do we earn trust? And it's actually it's a terrible question, because what they should be asking is, how do we become more trustworthy?
Okay, then I'd like to ask you this. How do we become more trustworthy?
No, I wasn't saying your question.
I know, I understand.
but you have to actually demonstrate that you're worthy of your trust. I mean, I think the first thing to get right is how people respond when trust breaks down. I mean, you mentioned Equifax and Sony and Target, but what you see is companies failing to take real responsibility and accountability for what happened. And this is terrible. This is the enemy of trust, because then what happens is people worry it will happen again. They lose faith that anything in the system has changed. I mean, you know, do you really feel like Equifax has changed as a company and as a culture and as a system? So that's the first thing, is actually fixing the trust breach. And then in terms of more long-term enduring trust, becoming more trustworthy, you have to be competent. You have to be reliable. You have to show that you care. But the hardest thing to achieve is integrity. And integrity is largely about motives. It's not necessarily about being a good person or a big company. It's about saying your interests are aligned with my interests. And I think in so many areas of my life where my trust gets broken, either by a company or another person, it's because there's that misalignment of interest. And so it sounds obvious, but this is the hardest one to get right.
All right, here's my last question for you, Rachel. We have a president in this country who for months has been telling the public that reporters and the media are the enemy of the people, and over the weekend announced that the FBI can't be trusted.
Yeah.
How much damage is that doing, not only here in the United States, but globally?
It's huge. It's enormous, epic, because what happens is that narrative in itself is incredibly dangerous. And I feel very strongly that we shouldn't be giving fuel to that fire. Now, every time we mention fake news, every time we talk about distrust in the FBI and the media, we're helping President Trump, because what we're doing is we're creating a vacuum. I'm doing it right now, right? Like, yeah. Every time we use those words, you create a vacuum, and in that vacuum, conspiracy theories can rise up.
Mm-hmm.
This very intoxicating, to some people, it's a form of transparency that is very appealing to many people. Voices that know how to speak to feelings over facts. And so I think this whole narrative about a crisis of trust, that he is a master at manipulating, is very, very dangerous in itself. And so I think we actually have a responsibility to kind of take the heat and the fire out of that, because we are, in many ways, helping that agenda.
Yep. We've even seen its effect globally in places like Myanmar and Libya in just the last week, where reporters have uncovered stories of corruption or cruelty and other things. Mm. And the leaders of those countries just say, oh, that's fake news. And they just write it off. And because our leader is saying that and leading the world in saying that, now other leaders are feeling like they can follow that. And that's really damaging in the long run.
It is. I mean, it's become a meme, a social meme. And, I divide my time between Australia and England, and the Prime Minister here said, I would never use that term. And if you look in the last 6 months, he's using that term. Fake news isn't information or news that we dislike or disagree with. And so I think, as writers, academics, as the media in itself, we have a responsibility to actually educate people on what that term really means. And that term is, it's fabricated hoaxes. It's fabricated truth that is intentionally put out into the world for some kind of political or commercial agenda. So I totally agree with you that the label in itself has now become toxic, because it's become an excuse to call something, anything we don't agree with, just fake news.
Very well said. The book is Who Can You Trust? How Technology Brought Us Together and How It Might Drive Us Apart. And this is Rachel Botsman joining us live from Sydney, Australia. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. Take care.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.